Hi everyone, good afternoon and happy Saturday. I am Sam Alberto, Samantha Alberto, I go by Sam. I'm an alum of SMC and also a current staff member serving in residence life. I majored in what was once liberal and civic studies. I think it's now JCL, and I'm finishing up my master's in marriage family therapy here at SMC. So thank you all for joining us throughout the day. And as we kind of end the symposium, we are going to be hearing from a group of alumni women across generations. And I really wanted to give a shout out to the Center for Gender and Women Equity, who taught me about the importance of SHINE theory that emphasizes collaboration over competition, especially among other women. And so this afternoon segment was really inspired by the virtual Black student convocation last month, where Black male students shared their perspectives of being a SMC student across generations. And I was inspired by to really bring the power of sharing experiences and storytelling to this symposium as we celebrate 50 years of women at St. Mary's College. And if you're joining us for the first time today, I wanted to kind of reshow the video that we started off with that I think really represents women in our Gale community. So, Kaylee, if you can, or Lucy, if y'all can show the video, that would be lovely. Thank you.
Celebrate the 50th anniversary of women at St. Mary's College, the beginning of our co-education, our first step into the future.
Whew, well, that video really warms my heart. I don't know if it's the music or the pictures, but it's just so nice to see women in this setting and representing all facets of the collegiate experience and kind of life on campus. So I really wanted to touch on today's theme of representations because it really hits home for me, especially during this time, this particular time that's marked by the impacts of a global pandemic, the persistence of racial injustice, the use of power and privilege to perpetuate systems of oppression, all while we individually work through how to show up for one another and remain present and also heal. So before I introduce our panelists, I really want to thank each and every one of you all who's joining us today for just being here, showing up, telling your stories, and also for the work that you do that is both invisible and visible. And thank you for being here today. So, without further ado, I will introduce kind of every panelist that we have and share a little bio of them. So, the first one up is Dr. Frances Sweeney. Dr. Sweeney graduated in 1986 with a double major in Spanish and diversified liberal arts. She went on to pursue an MA in Spanish literature from Middlebury and a PhD in Spanish linguistics from the University of Texas. A lifelong learner, she holds a second master's from St. Mary's Graduate Liberal Studies program and a CMT degree. Frances has worked at St. Mary's for 26 years as a professor, an academic dean, a vice provost, and now a vice president for mission. She is also the first alumna to come back and receive tenure at St. Mary's College. Thanks for joining us, Frances. Next up is Laura Garcia. Hello, welcome. Miss Garcia graduated in 1991 as a double major in communications and government. She is currently a morning news anchor for NBC Bay Area, and she is a multiple Emmy Award-winning journalist who has won the Associated Press Reporter of the Year. Ms. Garcia has remained active on behalf of St. Mary's College, serving as a trustee and regularly assisting in advancement and alumni initiatives. Thank you for being here. Next up is Angelica Garcia. Dr. Garcia, nice to see you. Graduated in 1998 in liberal and civic studies. She then pursued an MA in social work from San Diego State University and an EdD from San Francisco State University. She returned to St. Mary's to direct the High Potential Program and then left for a position as Vice President of Student Services at Skyline College. She is currently the president of Berkeley City College, and as a first-generation student, Dr. Garcia is committed to issues of justice, diversity, and equality. Welcome, and it's nice to see you. Fun fact, she was also one of my first supervisors here at St. Mary's, so super happy to see you. And Jordan Coleman, welcome. Thank you for being here. Jordan Coleman is a 2004 graduate of St. Mary's College and currently a vice president at Heffernan Insurance Brokers. During her time at St. Mary's, Jordan played on the varsity softball team and helped create the Gale Force that we all know and love today. Jordan lives in Walnut Creek with her husband and three children and serves on the St. Mary's Alumni Board of Directors. Thank you for being here and welcome. So, without further ado, I have all of these wonderful women on this call, and I am super excited to kind of just ask y'all some questions. Thank you for spending the time with us. And so, to kick off our segment, I'll just ask my first question, and it's popcorn style. So, I don't, whoever wants to start, go for it. So the first question is pretty broad. If you can reflect back on your time as an SMC student, how would you describe your overall experience?
I'll go first. My experience was awesome. I have or made a lot of friends that I still are am in touch with today. I got a chance to kind of explore who I was as an individual. As Sam mentioned, I was a student athlete. I also worked on campus and of course went to school, so I was very busy, which was a good life skill now that I have three kids and work full time, knowing how to juggle everything. But it allowed me to pursue my interests and really a lot of the things that I do in my current line of work. The foundation for that was created at St. Mary's. And obviously, I didn't know it at the time, but I was able to take away a lot. And it was just a great experience that I look back fondly on regularly, and really, really enjoyed my time there.
I'll go next on the heels of Jordan. It was just an extraordinary experience at St. Mary's. I grew up in the Central Valley, a very small town. And I remember the first time I went on campus and literally falling in love and thought, what a beautiful place. But then also all the amazing friendships that I made there that are still lifelong friendships that I continue to hold. And also with the professors, having that opportunity to have them get to know you and have them recognize your face and name as you walked across the quad. That was extraordinary. I got my start in broadcasting there. I was at KSMC, the radio station. I had a couple of shows. Let's Meet the Faculty was one of them. And being involved in student government and all the extracurricular activities and just kind of the basis for, what started out my communications career. So I can only say amazingly fond things of the campus that still holds an amazingly close part of my heart and who I am and who I've become. So always just amazing supportive situation that I had at St. Mary's. A great, great experience.
I'm so interesting. So, Laura, I didn't know that you were from the Central Valley. So I too am from the Central Valley, from Fresno. So when you said small town, I'm so curious which small town.
You're a big city girl. I'm from a little town called Porterville.
Absolutely. Okay. All right. I
Yeah,
figured.
so here's an example. So Porterville doesn't have any malls, so we'd have to go
Yeah,
to Fresno.
I know.
So she's a big city.
Well, I think that we shared a similar experience. You know, I was at a Christian Brother High School playing sports, and we had a doubleheader against Sacred Heart Cathedral Prep in San Francisco, and we stayed at St. Mary's in Assumption Hall when I believe it was still like a novitiate for the brothers or something. There were no students in there. And I remember feeling like, it is so quiet here. It's so pretty. There were deer walking around, and it looked very different than where I grew up or what I knew. And you know, my time at St. Mary's, I feel is very mixed. But mixed with a lot of really great learning. I learned so much. I had the opportunity to be a student leader. I had the opportunity to be a student activist. I think I may have been a part of one or two groups that took over the president's office during my time there. And so I feel like it was a space where the motto, enter to learn, leave to serve, really meant something. And you know, and my role now, as I think about being a president of a college, so much of what I try to emulate in building community at my current campus is a lot of, I think, some of the tenets that I learned at St. Mary's. And so, you know, it was one of the first times that I felt like this identity development of really coming into my own as identifying as Chicana. It was during that time that I was starting kind of the coming out process and getting together with a broader queer community that was very, very underground. And it was one of those things where I still remember going to one of the townhouses and walking in and realizing that there was this whole underground community that existed. And so we found each other. And so that's why I say it's a mixed bag, because it wasn't a safe space to be out and be a person who was also queer, you know, a person of color who was also queer. And so that's where I say when it's a mixed baggage, it's a little bit of that. There were still parts of, I think, who I was and who I was becoming and how I was coming to understand myself that didn't have as much free space to roam now or then. I imagine it might be different now. And I sure hope it's different now. And then the last piece that I'll just share is I really believed that I could make a difference. And I think this goes to what Laura was saying about faculty knowing your names, knowing who you were, like you couldn't hide, right? Like if you decided not to go to seminar, someone would track you down at some point. And so I think, that all of those experiences really created for me a belief that I could make a difference, a belief that I mattered, and a belief that there were others who were willing to do the work with me. And so that's part of the journey at St. Mary's.
So I first need to shout out. So I've known Laura and Angelica for a while, and they've been my mentors. They might not know that, but I look up to these women. I got to shout out the alumni office for putting this the video together. It was pretty amazing. And Sam for pulling this panel together. But, you know, these are what you say, like, I hope it's different, Angelica, now. It's different in part because you took risks to do things when you were there, right? So even though I'm the earliest, in some ways probably had some of the kind of that mixed feeling as well. So my first relationship with St. Mary's was actually the daughter of an alum. My parents met at St. Mary's in 1948, which is like this incredible story. They're going to celebrate 70 years married this summer, which is amazing, God willing. And then I didn't want to go to St. Mary's. So I've always, true confessions for those who know me, I've always had a love-hate relationship, and I love it. I mean, incredible experience as an undergrad, point to like the whole group bonding of like Mitty Hall and our games against, at that time it was not, De La Salle was co-ed and mostly men, but our games against Augustine, like Mitty all the way. So there's that bonding and the group things, like huge dances, the Halloween dance, like, right? We had a homecoming. It was like a different, so that bonding, and then also the freedom and independence of coming to know yourself and be the RA experience. Absolutely the fact, I am a Spanish professor because of DeSales. He was not he had left the brothers and then joined again, but he was DeSales, my mentor. He was in that video. Because I thought I was going to go to law school. And he was like, what do you mean you're going to law school? You love Spanish, like stay with your Spanish. And so And then there was also this mixed, because I wasn't even at the point of recognizing that I needed to come out. I just knew I was really lonely and part of me didn't fit. So I started St. Mary's in 82. There were two lesbians in Midi who both left after one semester. But it wasn't even a question, right? So St. Mary's has been my, and I never wanted to come back as a professor. So now that I've been here for 26 years, I like to say grace happens. It's like a magnet. So I had an amazing, amazing experience. And as Angelica was articulating, really growing and learning from others. I learned from our students. I learned from one of the first times I was brave enough to go to, I think it was called GSA at the time, right? And Angelica, and when she and her wife lived on campus as RDs. So like, we all keep supporting each other. We all keep learning. And that evolution is so powerful, right? So representations is a perfect theme. It's a great theme for today. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for sharing your experiences. I feel like as I kind of walk across the campus and kind of turning it, like going from a student to now a staff is very different. It's a very different experience. And then also just kind of seeing the evolution of St. Mary's students and how the community, especially as times have gotten a lot more tumultuous, I think seeing the community come together and seeing that community aspect at St. Mary's has just been so comforting for me, which is probably why I've been here for a while, but also to Francis's note about just kind of learning from students, and then also this grace of just having a call back to just come back in any spaces really speaks to me. So I just wanted to mention that. And then I also wanted to say, Jordan, I apologize for mispronouncing your name earlier. So Jordan, thank you for giving me that correction. I appreciate it. So the next question I have for the panelists, if you all can kind of reflect on some times where you felt your identity was at the forefront of your college experience. If it was, how was that? And what helped you persist through graduating? As we all know, it's been pretty tough to kind of persist through 4 years at St. Mary's, folks leaving, especially first a college that served first-generation college students, while also knowing that first-generation college students often leave. How did y'all persist through graduation?
So for me, when my parents took me or dropped me off to St. Mary's and we were moving in, and I grew up in the Seattle area. So for me, I came to St. Mary's really knowing very little about the campus. I came on a beautiful spring day, and the cherry blossom trees, or whatever the trees that line, you know, the drive as you go in. I mean, it was gorgeous. We all know it. So it sucked me in from, you know, the second that we ended up going on campus. But when my parents brought me and were getting ready to drive away, my dad says, I'm paying for one school, so you better like it here because this is all I'm going to pay for. So I kind of knew early on that I was going to be graduate through St. Mary's. But I will say that very early on in my time at St. Mary's, I really tried to dive in. I really tried to make the most of my college experience. As Sam mentioned before, I played on the softball team. I walked on. I was not recruited, but sports was so much of who I was as a teen and growing up that I wasn't ready to give that up. And part of the reason why I picked St. Mary's is because I thought I could still continue on my kind of collegiate athletic career. So I was able to walk onto the softball team, and being the, you know, sports lover that I am, I started working in the athletic department. So I really, like, within the first week had two kind of communities that I was a part of, both my teammates and then kind of being a part of the athletic department and working at games. That was back when we still had football. So a fall Saturday at St. Mary's Stadium is a perfect place to be. So I really kind of dove in. And I think that kind of finding my communities early on really helped me just make the most out of my experience. And, you know, when we all inevitably run into challenges, you know, because 4 years, it's a long time, even though we all know it goes by in a flash. I had great people that I knew that I could lean on in times wherever times got tough. So I think that was one of the things that really helped me. And early on, my identity was very much a, you know, female athlete. And a lot of my good friends today were either teammates of my own on the softball team, or they played other sports for St. Mary's. So I think we all had a lot of shared experiences of balancing school and athletics. So it was a good way to, again, find my community very early on. And we're, you know, kind of to this day are very supportive of each other.
You know, I'd say, speaking of an identity as a female, so it was the, I think on the one hand, there was just such a sense of, it's a great place. The faculty are incredible. I mean, I got my sense of self-esteem and confidence, as Laura was saying earlier, like in Spanish, and I tell this with my students now, like our goal at St. Mary's is confianza, which has three meanings in English: trust, faith, and confidence. But I think the other side of it is this identity around being a female at St. Mary's. I mean, you hear this like legends of someone who said, oh, there's not room on the campus for women and radios at the same time. Like, seriously. And that was someone we all knew. Like, seriously. And this was the 80s. Or the fact that I had brothers there at the same time I was there. And one of my brothers would always be acknowledged by someone. And he had a girlfriend walking with him who would never be acknowledged. So these like amazing like examples of horrible sexism and objectification that were present or in a classroom, the women, you know, you're not as acknowledged as the men. So that kind of stuff that existed, I'm sure it still exists today, hopefully not as much, but so I was very both aware of the identity and then but also in the 80s, there were things that you just was like, oh yeah, that's just kind of how life is. I don't know how much they were questioned. We lived within them. Right. And as I said, we learn from others. And fundamentally, just absolutely, I think when you say like, what was your identity and how did you persist? It really was the relationships with others, including faculty and staff, who were such amazing, amazing. And still today, I think rock stars who help each person do, you want to go to grad school, help you write the application, right? So incredible support and fun. I mean, it's like a really fun and academics together across different communities. Yeah. Thank you.
I don't mind going next. As you asked the question, Sam, there were two memories that just came flooding back pretty vividly. So the first was that the combination of I had the opportunity to serve as a resident advisor in Justin Hall for a year and a half. And then I was also a dining hall manager. And it was, you know, I'd love to say that it was because I wanted the leadership opportunity. I just needed to help pay for college. So that covered room and board, being an resident advisor and a dining hall manager. So because I was a student manager, one of our things was like seeing the back end of the house. And that was really getting to know the brothers in a different way. And that's where I learned, I don't know if it's still the same, but there were two different communities. So there was like the upstairs Alemany community and then the downstairs community of brothers, and really just connecting with them differently. Cause it was one thing to like see them in the classroom and walking around the halls, and then another to see them, you know, breaking bread and acknowledging the two different spaces and places. And so I really appreciated that. And I think I had the opportunity to probably have some good friendships, I would say. There are some of the brothers that I really respect and care about deeply. as a result of that. So that was like this flooding memory of not something that was in the curriculum or brochure. It was by total happenstance because of my job. But the other one was in 1996 was Prop 209. And Prop 209 in the state of California really put front and center the role and the impact of affirmative action programs. And where I remember being having it be really visible for me around my identity was identifying as Latina, really Chicana, but you know, at St. Mary's, it was like Hispanic or Latina. And there was the High Potential program, which there was this really amazing, strong community. I was not an HP student. And honestly, I think I was jealous that I wasn't, because it was like this natural community where they all get, you know, got the summer bridge, got to come together, first gen students, students of color. But it was Prop 209 was the first time that I really felt like I was in a college setting, a part of an opportunity to change the platform of the state, and just feeling completely demoralized by the outcome of it. Right. And so, so that for me around identity development was one where in my bubble of Fresno and my bubble of being a student athlete, I think I was losing a little bit of sight of the impact of like broader community. And I don't feel like I'm articulating it really well. I just feel like, you know, like you just feel like something big is happening around you. And I knew that it was happening. And I was like involved, and we went to Berkeley a lot, and there were a lot of protests and, you know, just all kinds of activism that really flared up for me during the time at St. Mary's. And now that I'm a college administrator and a college president, the grace that it takes for the college administration to give enough room for students to do that. When I think back to some of the stuff that we did, I'm like, God, I'm kind of surprised that they didn't call the police on us, to tell you the truth, because it was just like this other level. So I think I'll stop there with that, just in the interest of time. But as you asked the question, those were the two memories that just came flooding back to me.
That's interesting that you brought up the High Potential program as well. I was not a part of that. And now looking back as to what identity was at the forefront there, I don't know that I was certain of that or who I was. Or, you know, I was just a young Catholic girl that was looking for, actually, I didn't want to go to St. Mary's. I wanted to go to USD. And because my friends were from that small town. And my dad said, no, you go to St. Mary's. And if you really don't like it, you can transfer after 2 years. Well, I went there at a time when you were a freshman and you didn't get on campus housing. So I lived off campus for the first couple of years, which actually was difficult because you don't have the opportunity to make friends. You're not in the dorms. You're not a transfer student. You really don't have a place. So you almost have to be bold enough at that time to find your place and be outgoing and just show up at the dorms, even though you didn't live there. Or I remember at the time I got a job at the library and I met a lot of people that way as well. In fact, I met my future husband there. I mean, we reconnected after so many years. But in regards to who I was, as you mentioned, the High Potential program, I wasn't part of that, but they did have a program where they brought in Latin students to try to make sure that we were on track, to make sure that we were doing okay. And it was interesting because it gave me the opportunity to actually think, wow, I had never been actually recognized as that in a sense. I just grew up in this small town and I went to school and did my thing. But it was interesting. I think those were the very early stages of establishing, you know, that reaching out, you know, let's make sure you're reaching your full potential. Let's make sure you're doing this. Someone that was keeping track of me or attempting to. So it was really interesting there. But I mean, just making those steps and gaining my confidence, I think I kind of emerged. I think I grew there a lot, you know, I blossomed. And to find who I was and what I was to be and my goals and whatnot and having that support. So I think it was kind of, you know, the beginnings of forming what my identity would be for my life, in a sense. Does that make sense? Hopefully, a little bit.
Oh gosh, I hear you, Laura. And I want to echo that I also didn't want to go to St. Mary's. It wasn't my first choice. I remember stepping on campus for new student orientation, not wanting to be here, but my parents really loving the beauty of the campus and saying, no, you think you'll concentrate here? I think you'll thrive here. And I was like, it is so quiet. And then I also remember stepping on campus and seeing the different values that were placed on, men and women on campus, particularly around, I remember learning about a statistics about the demographics of St. Mary's at that time when I came in, where there was 70% women and then 30% men that kind of made up the enrollment. And apparently that was like a surprise because obviously for a really long time, they only admitted men. And so it was just interesting to see that it was a shock to everyone. And also, but then it was also weird because leadership on this campus was heavily male. And so it was really weird. And then the other piece to Jordan's point about being a female athlete and recalling my friends and I kind of noticing that only the men's basketball team or the men's soccer, like men's teams were being very like heavily publicized and got heavy attendance. And we were like, well, what about all the women's sports? And so really making a conscious effort to kind of show support and kind of that Gale pride everywhere we went, including women's sports. So that's what kind of came up for me as y'all were talking about just different identities. And yeah, it was such a transformative year for me, especially as like social justice just became very central to a lot of the students, I guess, at that time, my classmates and just the class years of just like serving others was just so central and making sure that everyone's voices was heard. Everyone had a place and a space. So it was really transformative for me also because I think I was oblivious to it until I came here. And now I just continue learning. And so it's amazing. So thank you all for answering that. And I do have another question that really speaks to kind of just the future generation of women. But I wanted to know a little bit about what you all believe will be the biggest challenge for the generation of women behind you as we kind of progress through the years.
I think probably one of the biggest challenges is I feel that especially, I guess it would be Gen Z and prior, I guess the whatever generation would be before that are all now, you know, really all really small, is that I feel that there's such a heightened awareness of, I guess, what's fair to as being females, as being a person of color. You know, there's, I think that, it's a lot easier to understand or to learn about, the actual history of the country that we live in and how there are so many things that, in the way that we live right now that were built upon, lies and misconceptions and prejudices, that I think that knowing that a lot of the truth is out there, and it's not difficult to really find, you don't have to look that hard, is using that to make for a better, fairer world. And I'm really impressed with generations that are before me and kind of how vocal they are. And I think that the challenge will be to not take your foot off the gas. And to continue to be vocal and to continue to take a stand for what you believe in. Because as we all know, once you leave kind of the bubble of college and you get into making a living for yourself, there's a lot of stuff that gets into the way. It's hard to support yourself with a job and to still be passionate about all these things. So I think that's a challenge, is to not kind of let up and still call people out when they're, you know, something is said or something is done that isn't appropriate or shouldn't be done that way. So I think that, again, there's a lot of great awareness, and it's just keeping up with that and continuing to maybe speak up for those whose voices are not heard or whose voices are kind of purposely quieted.
I can, I think part of what we're seeing right now with this pandemic, as I mentioned earlier today, right? Like the juggling act that women do. I was mentioning that at our scholars reception, which honors faculty and staff achievements last night, so many of the women seem to be like talking about these incredible publications and projects and grants, and feeling guilty that they hadn't done more because they're also taking care of their partners and their children and their home and working full time and teaching. And so I think the challenge will be to continue to recognize and what priorities and be able to juggle in a life where we keep having to ask to do more. I think each of us on this panel can name times where we had to make a decision to stand up for ourselves somehow, some way, to make a critical decision in our lives, to be vocal about it and to have that sense of faith, which for me, is like to be at a place that allows us, like St. Mary's, to bring yourself fully, to be able to say, depend on your faith, or to break down, to do what you need to do. Some of today's workshops about healing. So to bring the fullness and to be able to speak your truth, whether it's the truth of oppressions that we're witnessing on the news every day. I was telling him earlier, Jordan, I was following the NC2A story about the disparity in the weight rooms. Like that's still happening, right? We thank people like Laura for like calling it as it is. So I think that challenge of being able to both bring your fullness and also know that there are times when you're gonna have to make really hard things and stick to your truth for what's really important for you personally and for those you love, because the balancing act we've had in this pandemic just has pointed to it still continues. The superhero phenomenon of woman still continues. And like that's going to be the challenge of how do we change what that looks like for all, each of us, and for us together. Sorry, I didn't mean to ramble on. I had lots of ideas to like throw out there, seminar style.
I love it. Now, I think on the heels of that too, I think as women, we're used to playing that role because, you know, and it is hard to, you know, to say, no, I can get it. Okay, just one more project. Sure, no problem. I'll just get it done. You know, it is, I find that difficult for me to say, no, I can't attend that meeting and do this and do that. I just try to always find a way to juggle it and get it done. So that could continue to be, you know, and how much of that as women are we putting on ourselves, and how much is that of society putting on it? Because we've transformed, women have transformed from being the stay at home mom to now working. Now we live in a society where you do have to have both people work, you know? But then you're who's taking care of the kids and who's doing that? What is happening to the kids without a parent at home? I also see it as, I think working in news as well, it is so at the forefront right now of almost every story that we're doing. It's like life is like an onion and you're slowly peeling all the different layers off, all the different layers that have been trapped inside of there of racism that we're seeing. I mean, look at the Black Lives Matter, you know, movement that we had the last year. Now we're talking about all this Asian violence and some of these things you just can't believe they're happening in this day and age, but you're just constantly peeling off those layers. And having three little kids, I have triplets, so they're 11 years old, and having them grow up in this society where they see the insurrection on the Capitol, for example. And for them, they're just like, why are people doing that? Or they see Black Lives Matter and they're like, well, why would you treat people different because of their skin color? It's foreign to them, which is great because they didn't grow up with, you know, the years and years of oppression and all that. everything's at the forefront now. So I see it as a good opportunity as well of what's in front for women. You know, so much of that has been taken down. I mean, the Me Too movement, you know, that now that's an open conversation. You know, you talk to young males today, and this is how you treat a woman. This is how you do that. So I'm hoping with all those steps, it'll make things better for the women of today and the young ladies now growing up in the world. But I think, Jordan, you had a good point too. We got to press on the gas though. You got to keep going, because that onion, there's a lot more layers that got to come out. I mean, look at, we're in 2021 and we're talking about the mistreatment of so many different races from years ago and how it continues. But I think there's great opportunity for young women, but I think you got to press on the gas, like you mentioned, and just keep those layers coming off and charging ahead and, you know, learning to say no and learning to balance. You know, it's a lot on our shoulders, but I'm happy with the way I think the new generation is emerging, shedding a lot of those layers already. I'm hoping that.
Yeah. God, so well said. I mean, I think I feel like this is it feels like a small question, but man, it's incredibly loaded because it just brings everything to bear. And I like the analogy that you used about the onion, because here's what I wrote down in my initial notes, and then I'll unpack it. But I wrote, resist the patriarchy, resist white supremacy, because it's going to kill us. So like, that was where I started with it. And what I realize is that for many of us, we are often in these positions of being the first up. So whether it's the first woman or the first person of color or queer or the first person from a rural community, whatever it is, many of us, I think, as women enter into these spaces and into these roles, and you're the first of something. So not only do I identify as a first generation college student, I identify as a first generation professional. There's not a single person in my family that has the kind of occupation or career that I have. And so there's some things that I'm still figuring out right? But apparently your educational training and your professional, you know, you go through all of these titles to get to where you are positions. It's still not enough, because we're making up for the lack of making up for the lack of social capital that I didn't have growing up, that now my children, so Laura, to your point, that my own children will have a different life. So I have a 5-year-old and an 11-year-old. And last weekend, my 5-year-old, I walk out in the living room and she is like bawling and crying. And I have no idea what's happening. My in-laws were over. And so I asked them, like, what's going on? And they're like, oh, she's crying because of, you know, the lack of equity. Right. I was like, okay, well, all right. Not new to my family, but here was the thing. So every summer, my 11-year-old for the past 5 years has been going to this East Bay Oakland camp called Go Girls, which is everything about women's empowerment, girls' empowerment, production, leadership, all this stuff. And it's for girls or female identified youth. Right. My 5-year-old was crying because she was like, why can't boys go? That's not fair. That's not right. And so we had to pause and realize, you know, everything has to be age appropriate. You know, we weren't going to break it down for her about what that means. But in her heart, right, in her corazón, in her core of core, like, that didn't seem fair. So what it reminds me of, like, coming back, when you're the first of these positions that we occupy are positions of influence and consequence. So I'm the first Chicana president at Berkeley City College. And with that has come this gathering, the local community really feeling like they see someone who looks like them, who speaks their language, who's of their family and cultural upbringing, which is great, because I love the idea that the community feels closer. But there's also that the challenge, the burden. So Laura, you had said, like, it's a huge burden to carry, because it's like you can't mess up. You can't like have a misstep, because it could have dire consequences for the person who comes after me. And one of my femtors once told me, you know, you have to have to do this kind of work, which is in my case, administration, higher education, equity, racial justice work, you have to have shoulders of a linebacker, but the grace of a dancer, right? Like, you have to be able to shoulder a lot, but be able to be flexible and agile and move. And I think that what the generations of today have is the opportunity, I think, to maybe not have to work so hard at it. I'm hoping that those of us that have, like, you know, the generations that have come before me have, like, paved a road. We're paving it a little bit more so that when the next generation comes through, they're just smoothing it out, right? They're not trying to continue to break down walls. And then the last piece I'll just say, I know I've rambled a lot here, is I think that the other is sometimes the, when we don't resist the patriarchy, I think then women, we become our own worst enemies. We become our own worst nemesis. And instead of uplifting one another, it becomes a point of competition or tearing each other down. And so one of the things that I really try to focus on is, you know, be the person that fixes another person's crown without letting the world know that it was crooked to begin with, right? Like that we have that level of grace with one another. And I believe that this generation has the potential to do that and to pull from all that's happening in our world.
Wow. I really like that. The crown. Can you say it one more time, Angelica?
Really, oh, yeah. You know, and I'm going to drop, because it's a, there's this great activist artist who did it, and it's a beautiful visual, but it's like, be the person who fixes another person's crown without letting the whole world know that it was crooked. Right. So like, it's that idea of like, how do we support one another without shaming each other, without making a point of like, oh, well, look, I help you, so now you have to help me. Right. Where it's really about the bigger good. And I think around women, female identified space, how we do that and not tear each other down, because society does a really good job of doing that for us, that we don't need to jump on that. So that's where it comes from.
Totally. And bridging that to what Laura mentioned earlier about just the pressures as a female, and particularly one of color, who just are pulled to do so much and to say yes to everything and not given the time to step back, because we are also our own worst enemy in terms of needing to do the work and do the work for people, even though it's not really our jobs to do the work for people. In some ways, I reflect on like what I tell my students a lot is kind of when students of color, particularly females of color, who are just in so much and in so much in terms of leadership positions and involved in so many things, saying yes to, yes, I'll speak on that. Yes, I'll write on this. Yes, I'll do this. And then it's just from such a young age, we're being conditioned to that it is our jobs. And we do have to do it all, while at the end of the day, who's really taking care of us? And so I really, that piece of self-care, that piece of just like even boundary setting and that balance and integrating that balance in our lives is just so important, because we, at the end of the day, who else is going to take care of us except for us? So that was really helpful. And I don't know if Francis, you wanted to say anything, or Laura.
Well, I just wanted to add that, and not feeling guilty about it.
Yes.
Not feeling guilty about it, you know, because I think we also have the tendency to feel guilty about taking some personal time, or, you know, that enriching time. But, you know, that old saying of, you know, you can't, don't try to fill up others' cups until your own pitcher is full. It's going to make me a better mom if I'm more rested. Hopefully that'll come one day, but it's going to make me a better, you know, all these things. If I'm well conditioned and taken care of, you know, look at Jordan being a mom right now. That's what you do. That's what we do. And it's
awesome. It never stops.
It's love. I love that. I love that nurturing. I love taking care of people, but it is important to not forget, you know, who we are as women and our needs as well.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it's also just being able to claim the achievements, and like at this, and we talked about this earlier, right? Like being able to be celebratory of the achievements doesn't mean that we're denying the challenges, and consequent, and also conversely, like admitting and noting the challenges doesn't have to mean that we're not aware of the achievements and the celebrations. So I think when I first came back as a faculty member at St. Mary's, and literally recall some Latina first-gen females who were joining the campus who hadn't told their parents, and their parents were really angry that they were pursuing a college degree. I mean, in that, and in one case that the parents didn't come to the campus in the 4 years the student was there. And now when I think about our incredible Latinx graduation celebration that happens in the chapel and the family support. And so change happens. And it's that going from the first of that Angelica was speaking about to when I think about the different affinity clubs on campus and the student groups and like being able to just express your voice calmly and clearly and with that sense of grace. And I think that's what we are encouraged to do at St. Mary's from inside the classroom where, you know, faculty believe in us and challenge us in ways we did not expect to be challenged. As someone said earlier, like, you can't hide. Like, if you want to hide, this is not the place for you. And it's also the treasure, right? And then when you see what people go on to do because they've developed that voice and, as Jordan was saying, like, I got to keep doing it. I was astounded. And so I don't know, would we have known had Sedona Prince not put that video up on TikTok? Would we have known the situation with the women's weight rooms, right, on NC2A yesterday? And so those glaring disparities that are still happening, the oppression that's still happening, but just the right and the privilege and responsibility of sharing our voice, right? Not in whatever ways seem appropriate, I would say, but like you just see that happening again and again and again, right?
Yeah, I'm so empowered by this conversation because I just feel like you just got to keep going and really recognize the support that everybody has around you and really acknowledge and celebrate all of the small wins. I wouldn't even say small, right? All of the wins, because every day could be a challenge for somebody. So really just celebrating every day, celebrating that we got through it. So thanks y'all for answering that question. With the little time that we do have together left, I wanted to kind of open it up to folks on the call, guests. If anyone has any questions for the panelists, feel free to raise your hand or use the chat function to ask your question. That would be awesome. And I think Sharon might have had a question. I'm gonna
Sure, I'll jump in. So thank you, everybody. I'm really, really enjoying this. And kind of the last conversation, we already started to go there as everybody was talking about the multiple things that are going on personally and in this world, as we've seen racial injustice, gender injustice, and still keeping the foot on the gas, as another panelist said. I feel like I could take all the metaphors from today and keep them. And we've been referring a lot to the quote, life isn't about let me see if I can get it. Life isn't about waiting for the storm to pass. It's about learning to dance in the rain. And I keep thinking about that all the time. And I'm thinking about that here and now. And I'm also thinking about kind of what we do at St. Mary's in terms of really valuing the whole person, right? Like we're not just the people who come to school as students or staff members. We also have our whole lives. And I'm wondering, I think people have already started to touch on this, like what the aspiration of balance might look like. But also I wonder if people might be willing to share maybe an obstacle or a storm that you've had to learn to dance through as you are navigating the multiple roles in your personal life as you are in your respective professions. You know, Frances is an administrator, so is Angelica. I was telling Laura in chat, I'm up with her at 4:30 in the morning. So I know that you all have many, many things going on in your lives. And so I wondered if people might be willing to talk about that.
I don't mind sharing this. So I actually, when people ask the question around balance, I don't even try to pretend to find balance. I'll be very, very honest. I try to find a rhythm, and sometimes the rhythm feels a little bit smoother. But you know, during this pandemic, during this shelter in place, I feel really privileged that I have an occupation that allows for me to work from home, that I haven't had to worry that being able to provide for my family has been put in jeopardy. But it's really hard because, you know, when you're like, when I'm in this work mode and I sit here in this little corner of this room, on the other side of the door, sometimes it sounds like my kids are about to like break down the walls because they're all so sick of each other. We're all so sick of each other. And what I find is before I walk out that door, I have to take a breath and remember that my 5-year-old and my 11-year-old do not care that I just had to deal with addressing a major governance issue or budget issue or whatever, right? They don't care. They just want me to be able to walk through that door and be ready to like jump into the mom role. And at first in the beginning, I felt really torn about it. And I felt like I couldn't downshift. There was no commuting time. There was no just coming down from the energy of the work. And so now I do this little breathing thing to Daniel Tiger that has helped my Eliana, which is like, you know, you count down to slow down or something like that. And like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, I say that in my head. And so I'm learning from my kids, Daniel Tiger connection about how to center. I do that. I walk through the door and then I just try to show up for them the best way that I can. And so it's not balance, it's rhythm. And some days I'm better at it than others, to be very honest.
Thank you. Does anyone else want to speak to that?
I have the interesting profession of no one cares if you're having a bad day. My job is to be on the news and put on a smiling face. I'm a morning anchor, and luckily I'm a morning person. But I remember a news director when I was first starting out, you know, you go to smaller markets when you're first starting out. And actually I was working in Fresno. And I remember him saying, you know what, Laura, no one cares if you've had a bad day because they're there to watch you in and out on the news. And I can't bring that personal part of my life to that day. I went through a very tumultuous relationship and I had some very, very bad days and I couldn't show them on air and no one ever knew. Until eventually it came out. I'm a domestic violence survivor. And having had lived that and then having to come to work and be bright-eyed and you know, bushy-tailed every morning, that was a challenge. I can honestly say now looking back at what I lived through and what I survived through. So it's interesting though. I mean, it's also made me on the flip side, understand that in ordinary everyday circumstances, when something bad happens, it's probably really not that bad. You know, I can get through it. What doesn't kill you make you stronger, you know? And so some of those things, some of the adversities that come in our lives, the smaller things, I'm an eternal optimist as well. So I think I'm able to find the silver lining and try to just move on and move up. And we used to call it the 2-minute commercial break. If you're having a moment, you know what? I got a commercial break to get over it. And then you shake it off and you move on. And I think that's helped me with a lot of things in life and just, you know, living my life. And trying to see the positive in everything. I think it's really important.
Yeah, I'm gonna piggyback on what Laura said. So I think my biggest challenge that I've encountered in my life is when, I've 3 kids and my only son, my middle child, was diagnosed with a rare metabolic disease. And we found out when he was 4 days old and it completely upended our lives. The disease could have been life-threatening. It still technically is life-threatening. So there's like a really kind of fine tightrope that we have that we walk. We've gotten really good at doing it and he's great. Everything's fantastic. But at the time that we found out about his diagnosis, it was a complete, you know, to use a sports analogy, curveball that really upended our lives. And it made us realize that the only thing that matters is at the time it was the 4 of us, but now the 5 of us, and everything that we do in our lives is to, you know, support our family and make our family better. And so I think realizing also that there's something that happens in everyone's life. Like I kind of say, everybody has their stuff. So a lot of times, as Laura's mentioning, she had her stuff going on. You can't see it. So I think it allows me to kind of, allow other people grace, because you never know what's going on behind closed doors. And so when someone has a reaction to you, good, bad, or indifferent, it may not always necessarily be about you. It may be about what's going on in their own lives. And then realizing, like Laura said, a lot of the stuff that happens, we feel like we've been through some really tough times, but that was the toughest and nothing else has really come close to that. So we always know that we can get out on the other side and we're going to be okay. It might hurt, it might be a challenge, but we're going to figure out a way to get there. And I think that's been, I mean, as much as I wish it wasn't the case, it has made me a stronger person. It's made our family stronger as a unit, and it just helps us kind of continue on. And I think it's just unfortunately, a really good character building, but I'm grateful for the character that it has made me develop.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry, Sharon.
No, Sam, do you want to weigh in too, Sam? I'd love. Oh, are you looking at the time?
Yeah, I am. But
oh my gosh, we could do this forever.
I want to say thank you all for being, for kind of just bringing your whole selves in to this segment and just answering those questions. I know it could be hard and challenging, but also your truths. So I appreciate that. And I am looking at time, Sharon, sorry. And I want to be mindful of the panelists' time as well. But I also recognize that there are two folks that are, that have their hand raised. Hello, William and Luke. And so panelists, if you have to jump off at 4, if you have a hard stop at 4, I invite you to log off. And I just want to say thank you for being here and for sharing your stories and just your experiences. Really appreciate it. For those of you who want to stay on as panelists and kind of answer, if you'd like to, William and Luke's questions, feel free. But I just want to kind of give you that option of heading out. I recognize the time. So William, if you want to share your question, go for it. And then Luke, we'll get to you soon.
Yeah. It was directed originally specifically for Laura Garcia, but I guess any one of the panelists could contribute to this now that I think about it. But and when I asked this question, Edward Murrow's Wires and Lights in a Box speech from 1958 comes to mind. But how do you feel the current state of news media and the 24-hour news cycle that just sort of goes and goes and goes, how do you feel that contributes to and interacts with, for good and for ill, social progression and regression, just social change?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, thanks for being here. It's nice to see some guys up on the top tab too.
I mentioned Ed Murrow's speech because he predicted a lot of the sort of the constant ads we're barraged with almost word for word.
Well, and the there are so many choices for people to make, you know, nowadays. In yesteryear, it was, you know, the 5 and 6 p.m. news where, you know, you'd get home from work and you'd have stereotypically in the 50s, it was the woman at home with the kids and making dinner. And then the father would come home and go sit down and watch, you know, Walter Cronkite on the news. And that's where they'd get their information, or the newspaper. Newspapers are just, it's old news now by the time it's printed. Exactly. And now, I mean, as a broadcast television journalist, we're having the challenge of people not even turning on the TV anymore. The first thing, I mean, almost raise a hand, what's the first thing you grab in the morning? Is your phone. And you're able to get your stream of information, be it social media, be it a news feed. And hopefully people are researching themselves then, you know, between facts and fiction and knowing what they're getting. But that's our biggest challenge right now in broadcasting, is connecting to that audience who, I mean, everyone's cutting their cord now too, to save money and what they can get at whatever online as well. So I think some of the responsibility needs to fall on the individuals now that they're choosing to get, you know, from whatever stream that they want. Make sure that you're doing the research. I've got, a few teenage stepdaughters who will, their friends will come over and they'll say like, did you hear blah, blah, blah? And I'm like, where did you hear that? Did you research it at all? And it's really fascinating for them to now, you know, dig into it and say like, oh, wow, you're right. You know, it may maybe take a little longer than that to get them to look into it. But I mean, that's my fear as a journalist and trying to look into the information. You should know, you know, my political opinion whatsoever, because that's how I choose to, you know, to give the news. But I just worry about that with the 24-hour news cycle, that it's beyond just television now and radio. It's on your phone, and that's where everybody gets it, it seems like.
My mom describes the 24-hour news cycle as feeding the beast, as kind of just needing to just keep it going nonstop. Thank you.
Thanks.
It also just perpetuates a saturation. And so I think that to Laura's point, one of the things is like the space to just digest and reflect what one is learning or hearing is almost non-existent. So in my household, my wife, I would say of the two of us, she would be the news junkie and like follows all the things all the time. And for me, I'm like in the morning, at one point in the afternoon, and then later in the evening, sometimes I have to take it in chunks because I feel bombarded otherwise all the time. And I don't feel like I have enough time to then develop my own opinion. Sadly, I've seen too many people and unfortunately people in influential positions just, you know, retweet, requote, push something along without really acknowledging like what, to Laura's point, like what was the foundation of it. And then you just end up sometimes unknowingly becoming a perpetuator of incomplete information. And so for me, I just am like, that's the one thing where I can't hit that level of saturation because I can't afford to then like turn off to the things that I need to be paying attention to. And that's the other part is I'm seeing a lot of people who are like, I just can't take any of it. So I don't care to know any of it. And that's almost more damaging because then you're no longer, I think, an engaged contributor to the community and to the work that we need to do as a country.
Thank you very much. Those were both very valuable answers, I think.
Thank you for the question, William. Luke, did you have a question?
Oh, it was kind of just, I guess.
You're on mute, Luke. Okay. Luke, you're muted. You can
Sorry. My question was simple. It's kind of similar to Will's. Like, how do you deal with the barrage of like fake news and like new reaction media and just stuff that basically is just supposed to get you angry or emotional and is clickbaity? How do you deal with that?
Mine is researching. I mean, it's the facts of facts. I've got a team of writers and producers who, you know, get up in the middle of the night. I get up at about 3 a.m. We go on air at 4:30, but my producers start at 11 o'clock the night before. And, you know, everything that we go through, it comes through Associated Press or through NBC News. And so it's all validated. It's all fact checked, things like that. But I really find with so many people, I go back to getting, you know, their information from different sources, even in my own household. You know, they'll be like, did you hear that? And I'm like, oh my God, that's not true. And it angers me that that's what gets conversed about and talked about, is that people aren't taking the responsibility to fact check themselves. And I think that's really, really important. You got to know where your source is. Where did the information come from? You know, because we're able to get things so quickly now that people just take it for granted. And there's a lot of things that are disguised out there and they're wrapped in so many lies that the way they're able to tell it. So you really got to try to dig in and do some work for yourself and make sure that you're getting it from a credible source. I think that's so important.
You know, I think there's another side of that for many of us in different positions, which is because of the 24-hour news cycle, an expectation to be communicating regularly. So Angelica, I'm sure you feel this as a president. I know at St. Mary's, you know, when there's not a voice out there, when something does happen, and it's like, why aren't we saying anything about this? Or what are we going to, and when do we have enough information to comment? So there's another another implication of this 24-hour news cycle, which is, I love this whole conversation on voice, right? Because it's knowing what voice to hear and how do you digest the information and do the research. And there's also an expectation on the other side to be part of the conversation, right? We think about what happened this past week and the horrible violence. And so when do you say, we have to say something, right? And we might not know all the details, and how do we frame this? So I think there's another side of it in terms of the expectations to participate in the dialogue responsibly, right?
Yeah, and doing research, right? Just yeah. Because a post or a headline said something, doing extra research on that is super helpful. I know I, especially this past week with all of the AAPI injustices happening and just craziness, yeah. I see a video and I see a post and I immediately like feel something, but I need a pause because I need to take a look at, okay, where is this coming from? I need to look at, like, really see kind of like what is the backstory, just so that I don't get consumed by the feelings of rage and just, right, like disheartened. So yeah, doing the research is also very important. Mm-hmm. Jordan, did you have something else to say?
I think the only thing that I would add in is that I think part of to have a 24-hour news cycle, there's also a lot of opinion that is thrown in there. It's not 24 hours of fact. So I think when it comes to checking sources and all of that, I mean, it's also very human to, even if you are trying to repeat facts and give a version of events, it is through a lens. So I think, again, knowing that there's opinion, humans are writing these, not robots. It's not just going to be 100% fact the entire time. But like everybody else mentioned, checking sources, doing research, getting enough information first before kind of formulating your own opinions and sharing information and all of that.
Totally. Thank you, Luke, for that question. And before we wrap up, there was one more question that was sent to me in the chat that I actually think as alums would be really great to hear from if you have time, panelists, obviously. But the question is, how did you find students holding SMC and the college community accountable during your time here? So if anyone wants to speak to that. How did you find students hold SMC as a college and community accountable during your time here?
I'm still at the college or back at the college. So it's different from my student experience to when I've been back as a faculty member. As a student, I'm not aware that there were things about which the students were loud or together on one voice and holding the college accountable. I heard the stories about the Vietnam War when the students occupied the chapel, and that was when it was all men. I would say in my across the arc, I think the getting real with what needs to be done. So the 90s and early 2000s around, actually, I'm happy to say I was part of developing the Women's Studies and approving that as a full program. So the Women's Studies program, the Center for Women and Gender Equity, which had a different title when it first came into being, and then just the whole sexual assault policies. Laura, I think you were on the trustees when all that was coming through, right? So just holding the college accountable to being transparent, to doing the right thing. And I have to say there are times when, like when we redid the sexual assault policy, we got the best in the country to come look at sexual assault policies and develop that policy. So luckily there was some leadership at the time that really took it seriously, finally. Yeah. So that's one I'm most aware of. And then the student protests around DEI work, actually, in the 2000s. In the
90s, around the sexual assault, that was really Title IX. And so I know for me as a student, I vividly remember a group of us calling the then president and one of the vice provosts. I'm sure I'll get the title wrong, but they were two male brothers who, from what I saw, were like in a number one, number two, or one and three position. And some of what was going on around the country around Title IX and sexual assault cases and this idea that things are just getting swept under the rug, that was something that was really huge. So at the time, the campus did not have the blue lights around campus. I mean, you know, it's so dark. And there were a lot of things around safety as women that was a huge deal during the mid-90s when I was there. And so that's something that I think that when students do their job to remind the administration that the reason that colleges exist is because people believe in the value of higher education and because students believe that going to get a college degree is a value, and that as a college, we then serve students to support them, you know, in that journey. I feel like when students are able to do that, that reminds the structure, right? The people who are in the decision-making power, whether it's the president of the college or the board of trustees or, you know, someone who's an influential alum, it reminds us that we have to stay current with the sign of the times because it's so easy to get nostalgic. Oh, well, back in my day, we did da-da-da-da-da, right? And so, so that's the beauty of it, that when students voice on the what the experience is right here, right now, it gives the college a chance to make it right, I think. And I think standard student activist protests, it was taking over the administration building. It was the campouts and the chapel lawn. When I went back to work there at St. Mary's in the early 2000s or mid 2000s, that was around the DEI work. And when I believe the College Committee for Inclusive Excellence was born from some of that work and ethnic studies was born. So when students speak, usually there's an opportunity to get it right, I think.
And I think students are finding their voices even more so than when I was in college. I think, Francis, you touched on that as well. There were some issues that were coming up, and I think we were finding our voice. But having served on the Board of Trustees at St. Mary's, I can say collectively from the entire board, some of our most enriching meetings that we would have is when we would have students come in to the Board of Trustees and tell us what they thought. And we would ask them, what's working, what's not? Because we didn't want to just be this board that oversaw everything and like you mentioned, be nostalgic, because times have changed. And we have to remind ourselves that we are there for their students, for their education, for their growth and enrichment. And I was proud to see these kids have a voice and not be afraid and not just sugarcoat it because they were in front of the Board of Trustees. They would tell us what was right and what was wrong. And I love to see the growth. There are so many more groups than there ever were when I was there, you know? And there's so much more inclusion than I'd ever seen before. And I mean, you just don't want students to stop. You have your voice, use it.
I want to also just shout out at the time it was the GSA, I think we even had a name before that, Gala, G-A-L-A, with Professor Paul Gerlandi, and meeting off campus and that growing, again, student voice and support, and then getting to a president who said, yeah, there's no reason why we shouldn't have this public support student club, et cetera. And that was for me personally, a huge change in the institution.
Yeah, I 100% agree with everything that was said. I think when students write letters and raise awareness to inequalities and just issues and concerns and demand a response, I think that reminds me that, and it reminds administrators, like, hey, this decision might be out of touch with the student experience. Let's kind of take it back to why we're here. So kind of just to wrap all of the things that y'all have said, thank you for the questions. Thank you for the responses, the authenticity. I appreciate it. I know everybody on this call appreciates it. I also wanted to highlight a quick chat from Laura Wittenberg in the chat, just kind of shouting out her message. But panelists, thank you so much for staying over time, and thank you for being here. Clearly, we can talk more and more about talk more and more about everything as a community. Just want to say thank you all for your time. Everyone who's involved in today's symposium, thank you so much. I know we have a quick raffle that Kaylee wants to get to, but panelists, thank you so much. This really wouldn't have been anything without you all. So appreciate your time. Thanks.